This is just the beginning. I could see that the specks were actually large. Well, I saw the ocean, barren land, bright blue sky, then black specks dropped from the sky by the hundreds and landed in front of me on the barren landscape. I could see that the specks were actually large, shiny, black creatures with stubby, pterodactyl-like wings and huge whale-like bodies. Their heads were not visible to me. They flopped down, utterly exhausted from their trip, resting for eons. They explained to me in a kind of thought language that they were fleeing from something out in space. They had come to the planet Earth to escape their enemy. Am I boring you? You ever read Edgar Cayce's readings? I guess I haven't taken you to what the Dogon people ultimately say. Nomo came and told them. The fish-like creature from the land of the fishes who told them of the origin of the earth. That's another subject. I could see that the specks were actually large, shiny, black creatures with stubby, pterodactyl-like wings and huge whale-like bodies. Their heads were not visible to me. Turn it down a little. They flopped down, utterly exhausted from their trip, resting for eons. They explained to me in a kind of thought language that they were fleeing from something out in space. They had come to the planet Earth to escape their enemy. The creatures then showed me how they had... And we got that extra microphone. I think the battery's going on this one. Either get me some new batteries or let me change. Let's start with new batteries. You want me to continue or just... Is your battery gone too? Your ear battery's all right? The creatures then showed me how they had created life on the planet in order to hide within the multitudinous forms and thus disguise their presence. Now this would be right along with what the Cathars and the Gnostics believe, that the Demiurge created this earth. Did they go into the shaman state of consciousness? Well, we'll see. Before me, the magnificent of plant and animal creation and speciation, hundreds of millions of years of activity took place on a scale and with a vividness impossible to describe. I learned that the dragon-like creatures were thus inside all forms of life, including man. They were the true masters of humanity and the entire planet, they told me. We humans were but the receptacles and servants of these creatures. For this reason, they could speak to me from within myself. Now, doesn't that sound like... You know, let's assume the veracity of the shaman experience, that he's not a full shaman yet. This is the beginning. But let's also look at it from another frame. Doesn't that sound like the lie that Satan would like to have us believe if he could get us into a state where he could put these impressions on us? These revelations welling up from the depths of my mind alternated with visions of the floating galley, which had almost finished taking my soul on board. Now, I'd like to finish this shaman stuff tonight so I can get back. Well, I'm not going to finish shamanism, but I'd like to finish this particular story tonight. So hang tight with me. The boat with its blue jay-headed deck crew was gradually drawing away, pulling my life force along with it, headed toward a large fjord flanked by barren, worn hills. I knew I had only a moment more to live. Strangely, I had no fear of the bird-headed people. They were welcome to have my soul if they could keep it. But I was afraid that somehow my soul might not remain on the horizontal plane of the fjord, but might, through processes unknown but felt and dreaded, be acquired and reacquired by the dragon-like denizens of the depths. I suddenly felt my distinctive humanness, the contrast between my species. Hey, this is a PhD from Berkeley, not experimenting as a student, on assignment by the American Museum of Natural History in Peru. An anthropologist of renown. I suddenly felt my distinctive humanness, the contrast between my species and the ancient reptilian ancestors. I began to struggle against returning to the ancient ones, who were beginning to feel increasingly alien and possibly evil. Every heartbeat was a major undertaking. I turned to human health. With an unimaginable last effort, I barely managed to utter one word to the Indians. Medicine! I saw them rushing around to make an antidote, and I knew they could not prepare it in time. I needed a guardian who could defeat dragons, and I frantically tried to conjure up a powerful being to protect me against the alien reptilian creatures. One appeared before me, and at that moment the Indians forced my mouth open and poured the antidote upon me, or into me. Gradually the dragons disappeared back into the lower depths. The soul boat and the fjord were no more. I relaxed with relief. The antidote, gradually. How does your phone always... Oh, there it is. Okay. How do these phones keep going? I thought poor old Gloria, she's not old, I thought poor dear Gloria was being harassed again. I'm glad that you're not, Gloria. It costs $1,000 a second to talk any longer in here now. Gradually the dragons disappeared back into the lower depths. The soul boat and the fjord were no more. I relaxed with relief. The antidote radically eased my condition, but it did not prevent me from having many additional visions of a more superficial nature. These were manageable and enjoyable. I made fabulous journeys at will through distant regions, even out into the galaxy, created incredible architecture and employed sardonically grinning demons to realize my fantasies. Often I found myself laughing aloud at the incongruities of my adventures. Finally, I slept. He will go to an old, blind shaman later. Well, let's keep going. Rays of sunlight were piercing the holes in the palm-thatched roof when I awoke. I was still lying on the bamboo platform, and I heard the normal morning sounds all around me. The Indians conversing, babies crying, rooster crowing. I was surprised to discover that I felt refreshed, even peaceful. As I lay there looking up at the beautiful woven pattern of the roof, the memories of the previous night drifted across my mind. It'd be awful to go through that and wake up with a hangover. I momentarily stopped myself from remembering more in order to get my tape recorder from a duffel bag. As I dug into the bag, several of the Indians greeted me smiling. An old woman, Thomas' wife, gave me a bowl of fish and plantain soup for breakfast. It tasted extraordinarily good. Then I went back to the platform, eager to put my night's experience on tape before I forgot anything. The work of recall went easily except for one portion of the trance that I could not remember. It remained blank, as though a tape had been erased. I struggled for hours to remember what had happened in that part of the experience, and I virtually wrestled it back into my consciousness. The recalcitrant material turned out to be the communication from the dragon-like creatures, including the revelation of their role in the evolution of life on this planet and their innate domination of living matter, including man. I was highly excited at rediscovering this material and could not help but feel that I was not supposed to be able to bring it back from the nether regions of the mind. I even had a peculiar sense of fear for my safety, because I now possessed a secret that the creatures had indicated was only intended for the dying. I immediately decided to share this knowledge with others so that the secret would not reside in me alone, and my life would not be in jeopardy. I don't know where he concluded that. I guess misery loves company. I put my outboard motor on a dugout canoe and left for an American evangelist mission station nearby. I arrived about noon. Atheist now, heading for a preacher. The couple at the mission, Bob and Millie, were a cut above the average evangelist sent from the United States, hospitable, humorous, and compassionate. Well, I'd say all three of those. I told them my story. When I described the reptile with water gushing out of his mouth, they went to the book of Revelation, read the 12th chapter as I did earlier. I listened with surprise and wonder. The missionaries, in turn, seemed to be awed by the fact that an atheistic anthropologist partaking the drink of the witch doctors could apparently have revealed to him a view of an evil creature like that described in Revelation 12. Chance, probably. Maybe not. When I had finished my account, I was relieved to have shared my new knowledge, but I was also exhausted. I fell asleep on the missionaries' bed, leaving them to continue their discussion of the experience. That evening, as I returned to the village in my canoe, my head began to throb in rhythm with the noise of the outboard motor. I thought I was going mad. I had to stick my fingers in my ears to avoid the sensation. I slept well, but the next day I noticed a numbness or pressure in my head. I was now eager to solicit a professional opinion from the most supernaturally knowledgeable of the Indians, a blind shaman who had made many excursions into the spirit world with the aid of the Ayahuasca drink. It seemed only proper that a blind man might be able to be my guide in the world or to the world of darkness. I went to his hut, taking my notebook with me, and described my visions to him segment by segment. At first, I told him only the highlights. Thus, when it came to the dragon-like creatures, I skipped their arrival from space and only said, there were these giant black animals, something like great bats, longer than the length of this house, who said that they were the true masters of the world. There's no word for dragon in Conibo, so giant bat was the closest I could come to describe what I'd seen. He stared up toward me with his sightless eyes and said with a grin, oh, they're always saying that. Are you making any connections? Oh. The reason I'm trying to push your brain, you that listen through all of these sessions, and make you hang on to it, the gestalt's going to begin to come when you encounter. What we're doing is reading the reports of the four blind men who ran into the legs and the trunk of an elephant, each giving their own versions. I don't want to talk down to you. I'm just telling you, keep letting me dump all the mass. You're going to see some interconnections. Oh, they're always saying that. But they are only the masters of outer darkness. I'm telling you. Most Christians would not even read a book like this, but everywhere you turn, limited views of this preternatural reality are only going to be synthesized when you get the Hebraic Christian biblical view of it. Now, the old master shaman had made enough trips, he couldn't be fooled by the lying voices that claimed more than what they were. Like the demon continued to roar out in David, he was bigger than God. But this old shaman, he's not a fool. Oh, he stared up toward me with his sightless eyes and said with a grin, oh, they're always saying that. But they're only the masters of outer darkness. That's consistent with the prince of the power of the air, wickedness in high places. He waved his hand casually toward the sky. I felt a chill along the lower part of my spine. for I had not yet told him that I had seen them in my trance coming from outer space. I was stunned. What I had experienced was already familiar to this barefoot blind shaman. Known to him from his own explorations of the same hidden world into which I had ventured. From that moment on, I decided to learn everything I could about shamanism. And there was something more that encouraged me in my new quest. After I recounted my entire experience, he told me that he didn't know of anyone who had encountered and learned so much on his first ayahuasca journey. You can surely be a master shaman, he said. Thus, my serious study of shamanism began. From the Conibo, I especially learned about the journey into the lower world and the retrieval of spirits, the specialty of Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, who journeyed into the netherworld to restore Tammuz, and the bases of Satan's counterfeit religion. Let's go. I returned to the United States in 1961, but 3 years later I came back to South America to be with the Jivaro, with whom I had lived in 56 and 1957. My mission this time was not just to be an anthropologist, but to learn firsthand how to practice shamanism the Jivaro way. For that reason, I wanted to go to the northwestern part of the Jivaro country where the most powerful shamans were reputed to reside. Now, I'm sure we can get a copy of that film from the National Geographic. If the National Geographic Society owns it, I'm sure we can get it on shamanism. It's going to blow you away. I first flew to Quito, Ecuador in the Andean Highlands. I took an old Junkers trimotor down to a jungle airfield at the eastern base of the Andes on the Pastaza River. There, I chartered a single-engine plane to Macas, an ancient white settlement at the foot of the Andes in the midst of the Jivaro country. Macas was a strange village. It had been founded in 1599 by a handful of Spaniards who had survived the massacre of the legendary Sevilla del Oro by the Jivaro, and for centuries had been perhaps the most isolated community of the Western world. Until the airstrip was built in the 1940s, its most direct connection to the outside world had been a slippery footpath over the Andean escarpment west of the village, involving an arduous 8-day hike to reach the highland city of Riobamba. This isolation had created a white community unlike any other in the world. Even during the early years of the 20th century, the men hunted with blowguns, wore Indian dress, and proudly declared their direct descent from the conquistadores. They also had their own marvelous legends and private mysteries. For example, there was the story of how after the massacre and the retreat from Sevilla del Oro, it took them almost a century to find a new way out over the Andes. The man who had finally succeeded was still remembered in bedtime stories to the children. And there was the spectral horse, complete with clanking chains, which was reportedly such a frequent night visitor to the streets of the village that the inhabitants often huddled inside the palm-thatched huts while the monster roved about. Its visits ended in 1924 when Catholic missionaries permanently settled in the community. At that time, incidentally, there were still no horses in Macas or Macas. The first one, a colt, was carried in on a man's back from Riobamba in 1928, almost 3.5 centuries after the community's founding. Up behind the village, surmounting the eastern cordillera of the Andes, was Sangay, a great active volcano, snow-capped, billowing smoke by day and glowing by night. The glow, the Macabeos like to say, was produced by the treasure of the Incas, which they claim was buried on the slopes of the Sangay. My first day in Macas or Macas went well. My young Jivaro guide was awaiting me at the airstrip. The people were hospitable and generous. Food was plentiful, and our meals included generous portions of meat. Too cold now. Since there was no way for the Maccabeos to get their cattle over the Andes, they had to eat the beast themselves. Thus, cattle were slaughtered in the little village every day. In addition, they gave me guayusa, a native tea, which the Maccabeos consumed throughout the day instead of coffee. The tea created a sense of euphoria, and the entire local population was gently stoned all day. Guayusa is so habituating that before it is offered to a visitor, he is warned that once he drinks it, he will ever after always return to the Ecuadorian jungle. As I drifted off to sleep in Macas that night of my arrival, images, having drunk the tea, in brilliant reddish hues appeared to me in the darkness of the Maccabeo house. What I saw was most peculiar. Curvilinear designs intertwining, separating, and turning in a most enjoyable fashion. Then small, grinning, demonic faces, which were also red, appeared among the changing patterns, swirling, disappearing, and reappearing. I felt I was seeing the spiritual inhabitants of Macas. Suddenly, with an explosion and a jolt, I was almost thrown off my slat bed. You don't like this shaman stuff, do you? It's too cold in here. The dogs of the village burst out barking. The visions vanished. People were shouting. Just ordinary this time. An earthquake had shaken the ground, and now a spray of natural fireworks shot into the night sky from Sangai. I felt undoubtedly, irrationally, that the sardonic demons had produced the eruption to greet my return to the jungle and to remind me of their reality. I laughed to myself at the absurdity of it all. The next day, the Catholic missionary showed me his private collection of prehistoric potsherds from the local area. On them were painted red designs of almost identical to those I'd seen the previous night. The following morning, my Jivaro guide and I walked northward from Macas, crossed the Rio Upana in a dugout canoe, and continued walking all day. At sunset, exhausted, we reached our destination, the house of a famous shaman, Acachu, deep in the forest. There was no guayusa that evening. Instead, I was preferred bowl after bowl of refreshing manioc beer, or maybe maniac, monkey meat, and raw, squirming, but delicious cheese-like grubs. King's House banquet. There was no guayusu that evening. Instead, I was preferred bowl after bowl of refreshing manioc beer, monkey meat, and raw, squirming, but delicious cheese-like grubs. That's when you're glad you smoke a pipe. Tired but delighted to be back among shamans, I fell into a deep sleep on the bamboo bed. I remember some things they've offered me on the mission field. In the morning, Acachu and I sat formally opposite each other on wooden stools as his wives brought us bowls of warmed manioc beer. Breakfast, supper. His long black hair bound into a ponytail with a woven red and white strap from which a feathered tassel hung showed streaks of gray. I guessed he was in his 60s. "I have come," I explained, "to acquire spirit helpers, to Sintsok." He stared hard at me without saying a word, but the wrinkles in his brown face seemed to deepen. All of life is a matter of exchange. That's a very spiritual shaman. "That's a fine gun there," he observed, jutting his chin toward the Winchester shotgun I'd brought along for hunting. His message was clear. For the standard payment among the Hivaro for shamanic initiation was at the very least a muzzle-loading shotgun. The breech-loading, cartridge-using Winchester was far more powerful than the black powder muzzle loaders and thus much more valuable. "To acquire knowledge and spirit helpers, I will give you the gun and my two boxes of cartridges," I said. The Kachu nodded. Reached his arm out in the direction of the Winchester. I picked up the gun, carried it over him. He tested its weight and balance and sighted along the barrel. Then abruptly, he laid the gun across his knee. "First, you must bathe in the waterfall," he said. "Then we will see." I told him I was ready to do whatever he said. "You are not a Shuar, an Indian," the Kachu said, "so I do not know if you will have success, but I will help you try." He pointed westward toward the Andes with his chin. "Soon we will make the journey to the waterfall." 5 days later, Akachu, his son-in-law, Sangu, and I departed on the pilgrimage to the sacred waterfall. My Hivaro guide, his duties finished, had already gone home. The first day, we followed a forest trail upstream along a twisting river valley. My companions kept up a very fast pace, and I was thankful when we at last stopped in late afternoon beside a small rapid in the river. The Kachu and Sangu constructed a palm thatch lean-to with a layer of palm fronds for our bed. I slept soundly, kept warm with a slow fire they built in the entrance of the shelter. Second day, our journey was almost continuous climb upward into the mist-shrouded forest. As the virtually non-existent trail became more difficult, we paused at a grove of Caña Brava to cut hiking staffs to help us in the ascent. The Kachu briefly went off and returned with a 3-inch thick pole of balsa wood. While we rested, he quickly carved it with simple geometric designs and then handed it to me. "This is your magical staff," he said. "It will protect you from demons. If you encounter one, throw it at him. It is more powerful than a gun." I fingered the pole. It was extremely light and obviously would be of no use in defending oneself against anything material. For a moment, I felt as though we were children playing a game of make-believe. Yet these men were warriors, warriors who engaged in repeated life-and-death feuds and wars with their enemies. Didn't their survival depend upon being in genuine contact with reality? As the day progressed, the trail became steeper and more slippery. Often it seemed that I was sliding one step back into the adobe-like mud for each 2 steps I made forward. We frequently rested to catch our breath and to sip water mixed with the manioc beer mash in our bottle-gourd canteens. Sometimes the others would snack on the smoked, boiled manioc or smoked meat that they carried in their monkey-skin pouches. I, however, was forbidden to eat solid food. "You must suffer," Sangu explained.